Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, it is indeed about cheese and seed.
Cheese and seed.
There's something that would be a really good shop.
Name for a shop, yeah.
Where they offer cheese and seed.
And that fits both the...
And then if they have like good artisan beer and wine, you can sit there, eat cheese, and pick out your seed.
We got to patent this puppy.
That's a fabulous
idea. There's a multi-billion dollar demographic waiting to be served with a cheese and seed.
And I'll be the first one in line.
And I'll be the first one to eat.
Okay. But indeed, we are talking about cheese and seed today. We're going to talk with Ken Monteleone. He owns a cheese business in Madison, Wisconsin, called Fromage Nation, which is a great play on words.
That's Minnesota.
Fromage is cheese in French. And... imagination, fromagination.
May we, mademoiselle.
Yeah, pretty cool. Yeah. But yeah, they've got, similar to what, you know, we can find around here are these great artisan cheeses, fancy cheeses, really good cheeses, top quality cheeses, you know, made by some local folks that raise their own sheep and cows and stuff like that.
Did you have to wear cheese on your head and root for the Green Bay Packers?
I don't think so in this crowd.
Okay.
But of course, Wisconsin is known for cheese, and many of the cheesemakers up there now are making... you know, Gruyères and things like that, but they're from Wisconsin. So it's just some fat. We've tasted a bunch when we were there and then, of course, brought some home, and they're just really, really good cheeses. So we look forward to talking to him, you know, simply about the Wisconsin cheese history.
Yeah, it's a neat state. I spent a lot of time there. And Madison's a particularly nice town because the university's there.
Right.
There's a lot of diversity, a lot of things to do, and the countryside is magnificent.
It really is. It's beautiful. While we were there, of course, it was snow-covered, but that's beautiful in its own right as well. We're also going to talk with Claire Cool from Park Seed Company.
Yeah, we all get the 50, 60, 70,000 seed catalogs a week these days. And I wondered, we wondered, how this put together. What's behind the Park Seed catalog? And, of course, there's a lot more in there than seed, too. They offer a little diverse,
all
kinds of tips and comprehensive things.
Yeah.
And by sheer coincidence, it's their 140th anniversary.
Wow, that's a long time.
To put out catalogs,
Yeah, no kidding.
So we'll find out all about that and stick around, and Ms. Cool will tell you how to be cool.
That's right. Sounds good. All right, that's coming up today on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stay with us. In the meantime, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
I've expanded my wacky conifer area.
Oh, yeah?
Go figure.
Are they little ones or big ones?
No, no.
Because I know you kind of got on a kick there.
Dwarf conifers.
The little dwarf ones.
Au contraire. No, I lucked into, long story short, it's like one of these 8-foot, it wants to be a pine, but it's been cut back into one of those, what they call them, pom-pom things.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of fun. It's about
like topiary almost?
Yeah,
like?
But it's like extended arms with round things on the end.
Yeah.
No normal person would covet this, but it's now at my kitchen window where I can look at it. But I just like different kinds of conifers and shapes. And the point being, everybody should have a wacky garden area where they just let themselves go and just stick
Isn't
something.
Isn't that sort of the whole concept of Big Mill?
Yeah. That's probably my whole
Hello.
Life. Well, that's right. Yeah, that's probably true, but I have to justify it somehow.
Okay. This is the extra wacky part.
The ultra wacky Hidden Hill corner with conifers. It's terrific.
So you have the wacky conifer collection. The star of this collection is this wacky pine.
Yeah, it's about 8 foot and full of a pom-pom kind of thing. I've got maybe 50 or 60 other ones. I'm in mid-collection here. So it's just kind of fun, and boy, you got to have fun when you're gardening. You just got to have fun.
Yeah, and this is the time of the year you can certainly appreciate the conifers and their full-blown wackiness.
Now, how about that conservative, boring, dull, wishy state?
The conservative, boring, dull, wishy state. I am out still digging in the vegetable garden. Can you believe it?
Boring.
I harvested some fabulous parsnips.
No longer boring. You got my attention.
I love parsnips.
I know.
And I think I told you the story about how when I had some folks out, you know, touring the garden in the summer, actually it was our oldest gardener alive, who we love so much, Helen Trueblood.
Oh, yeah.
our daffodil lady.
Oldest gardener, yeah.
So I can't say she was sort of an old timer, but we love her. She was like, oh my gosh, what a beautiful stand of parsnips. You know, cause parsnips were supposed to be kind of hard to grow. And I'm like, oh, really? It was really the first year that I'd ever done it. And I didn't realize it was hard because I actually got lucky, I guess. Then I was reading that parsnips are best harvested after you've had a good round of cold weather.
I have no idea.
It sweetens them up.
Oh.
So when we had that little bout of warmer weather after it sort of dried out from the rains, I got out there with my garden fork and started digging them up. And they, because I, of course, eaten some, you know, at the end of the summer, but they truly have sweetened up, mellowed out and sweetened up.
Wow.
So it's definitely a good trick. I left some of them in the garden and, you know, we'll eat what I've harvested so far, and then I'll go back and harvest the rest a little bit later.
Amazing. So, you're also, on occasion, parsimonious. So
yes.
Maybe there's a combination here between parsnip and parsimonious.
There could be. That could be a word for your future plant story as well.
Parsnip?
Parsnip. What a weird little word.
It is a goofy word.
Yeah.
It must be like parsimonious means, well, not cheap. You're not cheap.
Yeah, no.
Frugal.
Well,
watch
some things. I'm smartly frugal. How's that?
Okay.
And extravagant in other areas, I suppose. Anyway, yes, if you grow parsnips, apparently they don't really like a whole lot of nutrients. So good, well-drained soil, not too much manure. Too much nutrients will sort of make them fork out. And then wait to harvest them after we have some good cold temperatures so they are nice and sweet.
And how about parsnips and cheese? How would that work?
You know, I bet you there's a perfect cheese to go with the sweetness of this fabulous root vegetable. Indeed. But we can find out. Ken Monteleone is joining us now. He's the proprietor of Fromagination, a new cheese shop in Madison, Wisconsin, which offers up the best cheese the state has to offer. The art of cheese making has reached new heights in this state. No longer does a good Gruyere have to come from France. Ken's going to talk about it. Ken, welcome to Homegrown. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Can we first talk about the history of dairy in the state of Wisconsin? It's, you know, known as the cheese state. What's the picture historically?
Well, cheese making really goes back. We have a rich heritage of cheese making in our state that goes back over 160 years for quality and craftsmanship. Back in prehistoric times, we had, when the glaciers came through, it left behind rolling hills and lush pasture land.
Mm-hmm.
Resulting in a great pasture for producing some of the best cheese in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And back in 1860, when European immigrants migrated west, they found the nation's heartland to be real rich in being able to produce some of the most beautiful pasture and dairy farms. And that really started cheese making in our state.
Mm-hmm.
So it dates back to around 1841.
Okay. So in terms of cheese making, the styles of cheese making, if you will, come from which immigrant countries originally? Do you know what I mean?
Originally from Swiss, and when you go out to Monroe, Wisconsin, it's still today. There's still a lot of rich tradition in families that have been in the area for over 100 years. So the Swiss really came in first and started producing a lot of European-style Swiss cheeses.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a rich tradition of producing a lot of Wisconsin cheddar.
Okay.
But one thing that's changed in the last 10 years in the state is really small batch artisans really honing their craft and doing some unbelievable, what we call today, artisanal farmhouse cheeses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, for a long time, Wisconsin had the image of doing a lot of your traditional commodity cheeses.
Right.
And that has changed with the advent of what's happening today in the state with some great master cheesemakers.
I was wondering, because, you know, in the state of Kentucky, at least, with the phasing out of tobacco and the encouragement of, like, diversifying the farm in other ways, the Kentucky Department of Agriculture has assisted farmers in wine making and, you know, cheese making, other types of things, not cheese making as much, but trying to work with the assets that are already there. And I would think that that was something that's very recognized in Wisconsin, you know, the fact that there's that strong tradition in cheese making. Are these artisan cheese makers today getting support and an encouragement from your state agricultural departments and universities?
Yes, wholeheartedly. There's also a lot of other divisions that aren't subsidized by the government
mm-hmm.
that are going on in the state. For example, 2 years ago, the Dairy Business Innovation Center started. And I shouldn't say it's not funded by the state, because it was a grant that was given to the Dairy Business Innovation Center
mm-hmm.
to go out and really help cheesemakers really set up shop and help them in the early stages of honing their craft.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, you know, we have the University of Wisconsin that also provides a lot of resources to cheesemakers. Wisconsin's the only state in the country that has a master cheesemaker program.
Oh, wow.
And in order to be considered a master, you have to go through rigorous training working with other cheesemakers. And I don't think that's a requirement in any other state.
Mm-hmm. Have any of the artisans sort of set up agritourism types of endeavors at their farms?
Several of them. A lot of the larger cheesemakers, such as Sid Cook with Car Valley Cheese.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has an unbelievable plant in Laval, Wisconsin. He is one of our master cheesemakers at the American Cheese Society this past conference won over 28 awards for his cheeses. And what's happening in the state is people like Sid Cook, their history of cheesemaking goes back 100 years, so he's, I think, the third or fourth generation cheesemaker in his family. And it's such a tradition that they have now moved in a lot of different avenues with cheesemaking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ken, what's your history with cheese and cheesemaking?
This is a whole new endeavor for me. I grew up in a family that was rich, and my family immigrated from Italy. So I kind of grew up in kind of a slow food environment. My family owned and operated a wholesale retail business specializing in Italian foods.
Mm-hmm.
And the last 23 years, I actually was in the corporate world as a buyer in footwear. So this is a whole new career change for me.
So you never milked a cow, huh?
Never milked a cow.
Boy,
but
you,
I always
didn't
had
miss
a great
much,
passion for supporting local businesses and,
yeah,
and farmers,
uh-huh,
and decided to leave the corporate world and start my own specialty cheese store.
Are you from Wisconsin?
No, I'm originally from Colorado.
Okay. So did you choose Wisconsin as a place to come and set up this business, or were you there already like, oh, Wisconsin would be a smart place to open a really cool cheese place because they're known as the Jarreds?
Well, it's kind of twofold. I was working in Wisconsin with two major companies,
uh-huh,
and decided to leave the corporate world, and I looked at what Wisconsin has to offer. And I, my background's more in marketing and buying, and I said Wisconsin, in my mind, should have a premier cut-to-order cheese store.
Yeah.
And there's no better place to position that than on the Capitol Square.
Yes, indeed.
So
right,
that kind of went into the process of coming up with the concept.
Uh-huh.
And then I started meeting with cheesemakers throughout the state and started engaging with the various divisions throughout the state that really work with the cheesemakers to bring, mm-hmm, the concept to life.
So let's talk about cheese.
Sure.
In a more specific sort of way. I had the good fortune to be in Madison over the New Year's, and after we visited the courthouse, we walked across the street to Fromage Nation. My friends that I was visiting knew that we were sort of stinky cheese lovers. And
I'm glad you stopped in.
Yeah, and
the wine
us,
didn't mean anything?
Well, the wine too, but
okay,
but they knew that we liked cheese, so we went over, yeah, there, tasted some fabulous cheese, and also purchased some to bring home. Let's talk about the categories of cheeses that are being made by the artisans there in Wisconsin. I know some are sheep milk, cow milk, sheep milk, and then there's different mixtures. Can you give us sort of a primer on hard cheeses, soft cheeses, all of the different things that can go into,
sure,
cheese?
Well, what's been going on the last 10 years in our state is, as I mentioned earlier, we were known kind of as the cheddar state.
Mm-hmm.
But what has happened in our state is we had cheesemakers that have gone over to Europe and studied with some of the best cheesemakers in the world and come back and have honed their craft and are today producing not only the yellow cheddars but also cave-aged cheddars.
What makes a cheddar a cheddar, Ken?
What makes cheddar a cheddar is before refrigeration in England, cheddar was always cave-aged and covered with cloth.
Okay.
So the flavors and the molds that are produced from the cave-aged cheddars versus the traditional yellow cheddars are there's a vast difference.
Mm-hmm.
So since that point, a lot of cheesemakers have really brought to our state not only some amazing cheddars, but we now are represented in every style of cheese by producers in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other styles would be the Gruyere category. We have an artisan, and I think you actually purchased the cheese called Pleasant Ridge Reserve when you were in our shop.
I think so. And then we also got the bandaged cheddar, which was,
yep,
fabulous.
And that's,
yeah,
the cave-aged cheddar,
uh-huh,
that I spoke mm-hmm about. And both the Pleasant Ridge Reserve and the bandaged cheddars are made by cheesemakers that, for example, the Pleasant Ridge Reserve is all, Mike Gingrich's, all his cows are grass-fed.
Mm-hmm.
So the cows graze freely on the land. So just the flavor of the and the profiles of the milk are a lot different than you would find with cows that don't graze freely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ken, I'm a little cheese impaired among other things, but I'm reading your menu here, and you've got cheese like 8 years old, and some that's 6 to 8 weeks old.
Well, yes, yeah, so we range them from anywhere. We just added in our shop a 12-year cheddar.
Wow.
And, yes, and, and when you taste a 12-year cheddar, you can definitely taste the crystals in the cheese from the aging process. And then we have cheese as young as some of our fresh goat cheese. We have one producer, Ann Topham from Phantom Farm, that she'll milk her goats on a Thursday and deliver the cheese to us on a Friday. So we have cheese that's less than 24 hours old.
What's going on in that 12 years that improves the cheese?
It's just the way the cheese crystallizes. A lot of people like a cheddar that's very strong. And when it's aging for that length of time, you really can taste the crystallization in the cheese to give you a really intense, sharp cheddar.
And then you've got goat and cow and sheep. The milk is all different and produces a different cheese?
Yes, and a lot of what we're seeing today, kind of Sitcook really has developed from Car Valley cheese, some American originals. And what you're starting to see in Wisconsin is a lot of mixed milk. So, for example, we have a cheese called Mobay.
Blended.
Which is a combination of goat and sheep, and then it's layered with a layer of ash to separate the cheese.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did is they took a cheese in France, which was called Mobier, which back in France before refrigeration, they would use the morning milk to produce a layer of cheese, and then they would cover with a layer of ash to protect it against insect.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the evening milk, they would finish off the cheese. And we have artisans in our state really kind of honing their craft and creating some great, what we're calling American originals.
These cheeses are so good. And, you know, as we established, there's a great deal of expertise and time and effort that goes into making them. So they don't cost, you know, $2 a pound. They're you know, pricier cheeses, although they're worth it. But when you do enjoy these types of cheeses, what's the best way to enjoy them, Ken, you know, in terms of using breads or crackers or fruit or beverages to sort of enhance the cheese experience?
Well, one thing first to talk about the price. You know, one thing that I've learned, when you buy quality ingredients, you tend to eat less.
You do.
I know I'm more fulfilled eating at a restaurant that really is more local and you know, buys all their food more locally than going to McDonald's and eating something that really isn't satisfying. You tend to eat a lot more. So first off, the price is higher than what you would find in your commodity cheese, but you end up eating less because they are full flavored.
Exactly.
And just pairing them with, I always say, you know, bread is to me the best complement to a cheese. A great baguette is pretty much a lot of times all you need to really enjoy a cheese. And just a lot of times, just eating the cheese by itself is very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you really want to explore the world of, you know, what we call perfect companions, we have an array of crackers for every cheese we carry.
Oh.
You know, from a Gruyere-style cheese, you know, we work with the cheesemakers and kind of tap into their knowledge of what they like to eat with their cheese, and that's kind of our starting point in really educating our customers on what to enjoy with, for example, a Pleasant Ridge Reserve. So, for example, sticking with Pleasant Ridge Reserve, a great rosemary-flavored cracker or bread pairs nicely with a very creamy, buttery cheese like Pleasant Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the ice wines, more sparkling wines, work well. So it's a wide-open market in terms of what's available today and really just exploring and having fun tasting different cheese with different crackers and preserves and chutneys.
Mm-hmm.
Is kind of the starting point.
So any given point in time, how many different cheeses do you have and how many pounds do you have on hand there in Wisconsin?
We have around, we keep it to around 80 to 100 cheeses, and over 60% of them are local from Wisconsin, and then the rest are from various parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the month of December, we went through probably 1,500 pounds of cheese.
Wow.
So at any given time, we have a substantial amount in our shop.
What was the biggest surprise you found in the business starting with knowing nothing?
The biggest surprise is just the passion that these cheesemakers have. I shouldn't say it's a surprise, but just what really made me pursue my concept is the dedication, the passion, and the commitment that the cheesemakers have to really make honing their craft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a lot of these people, they're not making a lot of money doing that, but they take great pride in really caring for their animals and producing a great milk to produce an unbelievable cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And the most fulfilling thing about the shop is really working closely with these cheesemakers and really get to know their practices so that we can pass on that knowledge to our customer.
So have you noticed from your the cheesemakers that you're working with, do you feel confident that there's a next generation to sort of pass the baton to?
Yes, I think we're fortunate in the state of Wisconsin because we are a state that is a lot about supporting local and buying local. And what that is, what's happened with the advent of our farmers market is you have a lot of people that are choosing more farm-related careers in our state because of what's happening with cheese right now.
Excellent.
And a lot of our cheesemongers that work in our shop actually are going to be going out working with the cheesemakers. So my hope is that eventually they'll be enticed to follow the next generation.
Excellent. Ken, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We love your cheeses and your cheesemakers in Wisconsin.
Well, thank you.
Ken Monteleone is the proprietor and head cheesemonger of Fromagination in Madison, Wisconsin, where you can sample the great cheeses of Wisconsin and the world. If you visit Madison, they're on the square off the state capitol, or you can visit them via the internet at fromagination.com. And of course, for more information, you can visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, the most recognized name in plant catalogs, Park Seeds. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And I can smell some seeds to go with the cheese.
Yeah.
This is a concept, kiddo.
I think it's really, really, really good.
Cheese and seed.
Concept.
Somebody call us with $1 billion.
And we'll do your cheese and seed
I'll
shop.
Do the seeds. Janine can do the cheese.
Yeah. And we can probably fold in some other culinary
wine
and good beer. And
ooh.
I think the possibilities are in. Oh,
I can milk the goats.
Oh boy, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get through this interview.
But meanwhile, we've got seeds to talk about.
We do have seeds to talk about.
And the still. Park Seed Company, one of the oldest in the history of the world, actually. With us to talk about that is Claire Cool. She's Special Projects Director with the Park Seed Company of South Carolina. As such, she's involved with the care and feeding of the park catalog. Well, Claire, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be chatting with you today.
Yeah, I'm a long-time user and connoisseur of Park Seed Catalog myself, and this is your 140th year. Tell us something about the history.
Well, it's a fascinating history. Do you by any chance have teenagers in your life?
Not anymore, thank God.
Yeah.
Well, you can probably remember that when you did have them, one thing they never had enough of was money.
Right.
Well, oddly enough, that was true even in 1868 when our company was founded.
Wow.
A 16-year-old boy named George Watt Park needed some pocket money.
Huh.
And being an avid gardener, he thought that if he could harvest the seeds from his little corner of the backyard that his mom let him have, if he could harvest those and sell them, he might be able to pick up a few bucks.
Wow.
So he bought a hand press and printed up a list of seeds. He also took an ad in the Rural American newspaper. Spent $3.50.
Wow.
When all the dust settled, he walked away with $6.50, and a lifetime pursuit was formed. He was spent literally the rest of his life selling seeds and making the most of the direct marketing tools available to him.
Huh.
So that was the first catalog, in a sense.
In a sense, yeah, absolutely.
And where was this at again, did you say?
It was in Libonia, Pennsylvania. That's where George grew up.
Wow. Should have known that.
So how did it evolve?
Well, obviously it was a success, and he continued to pursue it. He had so much mail-order activity going on, he had to relocate from Libonia to a place called Paradise, Pennsylvania, because it was closer to the train mail stop.
Okay.
And as a side note, George, like all of us in business today, constantly got letters from people saying, "Oh, I love your products. Send me some for free."
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
You know, for the home demonstration group or the school or whatever.
Right.
It was his practice to send a letter that said, "I cannot spare my products for free, but you can always have the benefit of my advice."
Oh, excellent.
Well, there was an enterprising young home demonstration agent in a small town in South Carolina who took him up on the advice thing.
Oh.
And they wrote back and forth. They tell me in the family archives there are 40-page letters back and forth.
Wow.
And eventually, on a business trip, George traveled to Greenwood, South Carolina, and met the lovely Mary Barrett. They fell in love and got married.
Oh, how sweet.
He sold the seed, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, she finally had all the free seed she could use.
Yeah, no kidding. So is that how it landed itself in South Carolina?
Correct. They they tried Florida, and it was just a miserable place to try to keep seeds fresh in those pre-refrigeration days.
Sure. Yeah.
And they landed upon the idea of returning to her hometown. Uh-huh. And that's how Greenwood lucked out and got Park Seed Company.
So has the company always raised its own seed, and do you do that now, or do you have other sources for them?
Well, as the business grew, and I can't tell you the exact cutoff point,
right. But
as the volumes grew, it was no longer practical to do all the seed growing.
Right.
And also, as you undoubtedly know, gardening is such a fashion-oriented business.
Yes.
That you really have to stay in touch with the cutting-edge developers if you want to have the latest and greatest to offer your customers. Mm-hmm.
So do you contract with people to grow for you specifically?
We do, all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
All the best developers and growers, we work with them and try to have always something new and exciting as well as the standards to offer our customers. Mm-hmm.
So originally, was the catalog all just seeds? Because certainly you're not just seeds now. But was the catalog just seeds?
Well, the lovely thing about the original catalogs, the early catalogs, even up into the 1960s, is that it was actually called Park's Floral Magazine.
Oh.
And I'm looking right now at my copy of the 1899 Park's Floral Magazine from June of 1899. And on the front cover, the choice plants that we're offering as a premium include phlox and plumbago, begonia, canna, coleus, tuberose. So those were popular then and remain popular now.
And selling for how much in 1890?
25 cents, I believe.
Outrageous. Yeah.
And I pay the postage and guarantee their safe arrival. The other thing that's great, though, it's truly a magazine. There are lots and lots of letters from satisfied customers. There's poetry. There's George Watt Park describing his recent trip to Italy. It's truly an informative little magazine. And the thing that will crack you up most of all is to look at the other ads in the magazine.
So Claire,
the back cover is devoted to why women have weak lungs. Not only is woman naturally man's inferior in physical strength and vigor. Yeah, I will not continue.
Push your hand to your brow there.
Yeah, so Claire... sometimes I think we get too many catalogs of the same catalog sometimes filling the mailbox.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, how often would they publish the magazine?
I don't have good data on that.
Okay.
I know in the, for example, in the 1900s, I believe it was monthly.
Wow. So that's still kind of a lot.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Of course, everything is easier and cheaper when it comes to publication now that we live in the internet age.
Exactly.
But catalogs are still a very important piece of what we do.
Yeah.
Can you give us a sense of maybe the circulation 100 years ago compared to now?
Well, it continues to grow. A couple of years ago, I believe we mailed out something in the order of 11 million catalogs.
Holy cow.
Wow.
What it was earlier, I'm sure it was in the hundreds of thousands, even in the 1800s. I have seen data on that.
Yeah.
In fact, right here on the front cover of the 1899 issue, for May, the number of copies printed, as indicated by the press counters, was 362,500.
Huh, that's a lot.
It's still a bunch.
So when I think about that time frame, not that far after the Civil War, 300,000 books going out, that's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder the post office liked it.
It's amazing. And then how much product would there have been in that catalog 100 years ago compared to now? How many items?
Oh, not nearly as many.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, much of the publication was devoted to things other than the hard sell.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Today's catalogs, we try to have anywhere from 1,200 to 2,000 items in the seed catalog.
Wow. Now, each one of those is field tested somewhere before you ship it out, right?
Absolutely. We are proud members of the All America Select organization.
Okay.
We participate as purchasers with the pack trials out of California. We want to make absolutely sure that, that what we are offering to the customers has been proven and tested. And, of course, we have our very own trial garden. We are a trial garden for All America Selections, and we do a lot of our own trials just, you know, for our own doggone satisfaction. That's why the 9-acre front yard to our national headquarters here in Greenwood is much of it is devoted to road trials, as well as to a number of different theme gardens, so you can see the different products in context and see how they behave.
Open to the public?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Anybody, anytime can come stroll through the garden.
Incredible.
One day a year, our professional horticulturalists actually offer guided tours through the garden.
Oh.
That's our annual Flower Day. It's part of the South Carolina Festival of Flowers, which is a three-week spectacular of all kinds of fun things, from a triathlon, classic car shows, you know, et cetera, tours of private gardens in the area. But we have 3,000 to 6,000 of our closest friends stroll through the front yard, actually hear our horticulturalists speak, have them explain, you know, what they've chosen and why these things are in the garden, et cetera. It's an awful lot of fun.
What day is that this year?
For 2008, it's scheduled for Saturday, June the 21st.
Mm-hmm.
And there's absolutely no charge.
Hmm. Wow.
So let's talk a little bit more about the production of the contemporary catalog. Big business, certainly. It's also so much fun, and so many people look forward to perusing the catalogs this time of the year. I know that I do. Is there an art to crafting a really good, you know, seed and plant catalog?
Well, as is true with most things related to gardening, there is both science and art involved.
Uh-huh.
A wise cataloger, regardless of product line, will do what's called a square inch analysis. And looking at, you know, last season's catalog, this little ad in the upper left-hand corner of page 3, how many bucks did that bring in?
Uh-huh.
And you do that for every spread and see where people were attracted and what right. really caught on with them.
So you can sort of analyze how much you sold of a certain plant
exactly.
from the last year based on where it was situated in the catalog.
Right. That's one of the factors. We have, of course, with our strong internet presence, is a different level of analysis.
Right.
But that's part of the picture. We study the best practices of how, you know, when the human eyeball rolls across the page, where does it start, where does it land, and where do we want to have the exciting, sexy stuff positioned.
Uh-huh.
But so much of the art lands on the shoulders of our horticulturalists as they roam the pack trials, as they are looking today for what's going to be exciting in 2010.
Uh-huh.
Right.
It's their knowledge as gardeners to the bone,
right.
what's going to be fun and exciting and add value, be fashionable. So a lot of it is their finely honed instinct on what they want to offer to the customers.
That's what sells
it
ultimately.
And what fits with our ethos and our position in the marketplace.
Well, let's leap ahead then to the future in the online catalog.
The future is now.
Exactly. When did that become a factor in your sales, and how has that evolved over the years?
Well, it's my understanding that our first internet presence was in around 1996. It was there. It was very rudimentary. It was there because everybody was saying that's the place to be.
Right.
Yeah.
But by the time you hit 2006.
Yeah.
We've reached the tipping point. That is the first sales year where the internet revenue outstripped the catalog revenue.
Oh, the future.
So we saw that gap expand in 2007, and we know that it's quite likely will continue with that kind of balance.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, the catalog is still important.
Right.
The catalog is what people like to kick back in the easy chair and circle and dog ear and muse and ponder. And then a very high percentage will then take that beaten up, marked up catalog, walk over to the internet, and place the actual order.
Yeah.
Amen, sister.
Yeah. I mean, honestly,
been there, done that. Huh?
I like that. And to look back at as a reference and educational tool as well. So since 1996, and internet sales are higher than catalog sales, you have not decreased the number of catalogs you sent out, have you?
Well, we constantly fine-tune and experiment.
Okay. Because as you say, the two really do kind of go hand in hand.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And we don't always know who started where.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, because you can come to the internet site, see, send me the catalog, and click to get the catalog. Or you may have received the catalog in the mail, and that drives you to the internet.
Right.
So it's again, art and science, trying to understand the right balance. So we're giving the customer what they need, when they need it, in the way that they prefer. And that's always the challenge.
Yeah, and as with newspapers, I'm sure the younger customers never use a catalog and never will. They're just so online conscious, that's all they ever use. So it's a whole evolution coming at you that way, too.
Yeah, it's the gardening market space certainly is heavily weighted toward, shall we say, more seasoned individuals.
yeah, like, right.
Beautifully put.
Like me.
Yeah. Right.
The baby boom group is certainly coming into its own in terms of gardening. There's also a bit of a spike. Younger people who are not yet married but who are purchasing their first homes have at least a fundamental desire for some basic landscaping and may find their way into to more recreational gardening. And the impetus for being more green in our lifestyle, some young families are getting into gardening more than they might have in the past, both educationally for the kids and with the idea of have you heard the new word locavore?
No.
Locavore. You know what a carnivore is?
Sure.
Somebody that eats meat.
And it makes sense because they're sort of pushing that whole eat locally.
Exactly.
Whether it's organic or not.
Locavore is a person who eats food grown as close to home as possible.
Uh-huh. Oh.
And there's nothing much closer than your own backyard.
Thank you. Amen to that, sister.
So we're seeing, I think, there's always been a fear that gardening not being an interactive video game was going to fade off. But there are other societal directions that will continue to bring gardening to the forefront as a satisfying pursuit on any number of levels.
Are you answering questions online now, too, with Park?
Oh, absolutely. We've always done that. We have two horticulturalists full-time in the customer service area.
Ah.
You can either call the 800 number from the catalog or send questions. I believe there's info at Park Seed down at the bottom of the website. You can click on to get the email address. And we are delighted to answer horticultural questions.
Any new marriages come from that this time of in this era?
That's true.
No love matches.
Well, we haven't pursued that. There've been the odd employee hookups, but that's a different issue.
But not through the question and answers.
So. Not so far. But if I might share something with you, we've long had, as I mentioned, since 1996, we've had the site you can go to buy stuff.
Right.
But when you start talking about the community of gardeners wanting to ask questions, wanting to share information, we've spent a good deal of effort in the last year creating some websites that are sponsored by Park Seed, Wayside Gardens, Jackson and Perkins, but aren't necessarily the hard sell site.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we have successwithseed.org. If you're into seed starting, we've got the entire contents of Park Success with Seed book available online.
Mm-hmm.
We have a horticulturalist who monitors that site, monitors the forums, answers all the emails. It's quite a lovely, content-rich site if you want information and don't just want to browse through the material for sale.
Hmm. You mentioned Wayside and Jackson and Perkins. Are they part of the family now, too?
Well, Wayside Gardens is part of the family, and we have a business relationship with Jackson and Perkins,
okay.
So we're starting to do a little bit of cross-promotion back and forth.
Separate catalogs there, though, too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's a different, each addresses
right.
a slightly different audience.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's why there's good synergy for us to be good business colleagues.
Well, Claire, thank you very much. This has been enjoyable and fun and interesting and educational.
Well, I am delighted to have delivered on all those fronts. I'm sure it's on my mind.
Okay.
Thank you, Claire.
Thank you. It's you're entirely welcome, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Claire Kuhl is a special projects director with the Park Seed Company in South Carolina. For more information on the Seed Company and its catalogs, visit the Homegrown page at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, to listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With a couple dangling questions to be participled here.
Yes, we do have some questions. How about I begin with this one?
Yes, ma'am.
From Rosemary Dawson. She says that she has a hemlock tree that is in distress, which is not really surprising.
Right.
It has lost many of its needles and is a pale green. It does have tiny pine cones and is maintaining right now, but what can I do to help it? Is there a fertilizer that would help? Would composting or mulching help? Thanks, Rosemary.
Yeah, fertilizing will help, but not now. You want to wait on that. And basically, it's hemlocks, you know, this drought, and we're going to see a lot of this drought last summer, maybe catching up to it.
Yeah.
And it just may be in distress from that and previous strange seasons.
Yeah, because hemlocks are very susceptible to drought, and I think people think that they're a tougher plant than they are. The way that we use them in our landscape is they like really good drainage, so they don't like it real wet.
Right.
And then, of course, they don't like it really
dry
either. So, and the downside too, Bob, once an evergreen starts to show major signs of stress,
it's usually too late. Yeah, call Ratterman.
Yeah.
It's about over then. Yeah. It's tough.
But she does hit on fertilizing now is not a good idea, but maybe a little bit in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And then composting and mulching absolutely is what we should always do for our plants. That's the best way to sort of fertilize them, if you will, and also the best way to help moderate and maintain whatever soil moisture is available. So no matter what, always compost and mulch. But unfortunately, it may be a little too late for this hemlock.
But don't give up, Rosemary. Hang in there.
It'll show clear signs by spring whether or not it's on its way out. So.
And I talk to my trees. That's important. I go out and talk to them. I do. I talk to my trees, and they listen to me. And Next question. About blackberries, which you know a lot about, and me almost nothing.
Okay.
What would be the best times from Harv? Sorry, Harv. When would be the best time to prune tame blackberries, and how far back should I prune them?
It's one of the chores that's on my list of things to do right now. You want to make sure that you prune away last year's fruiting canes.
Okay.
Because they're not going to fruit again.
Ah.
And you also want to prune them all the way down to the ground.
Okay.
Because they're not going to fruit again. And they could harbor disease. So you always want to get that stuff out of there so that it can't spread disease to the new canes. The canes that grew brand new this year, that's what you want to save because that's what's going to bear your fruit next season.
As in last spring and summer and fall?
Right. The brand new growth from this year wouldn't have fruit on it.
Right.
And that's what you want to save over for next year. But the stuff that fruited this year, get rid of it.
Gotcha. How about raspberries while we got you on this subject?
That gets a little bit more complicated because some are everbearing, some are
early,
some are late. We usually get everbearing varieties so that we can cut them back all the way to the ground because it helps with disease management. We forgo that first round of fruit, and then we just have a later summer fruit. So
good. You did so well on that. Your bonus is another question for you.
All right.
This is from Brian in the Highlands. Interesting question.
Okay.
He lives in an older neighborhood in the Highlands.
Uh-huh.
House next to him has been undergoing renovation, power washing the exterior, left a lot of paint chips all over his side yard where he has some perennial flower beds. Been difficult to remove all the chips.
Yeah.
Will these chips in the soil harm my plants? Do I need to remove all traces of this paint? I plan to increase my planting beds in that part next spring. Would like to know. Thanks, Brian.
I would, Brian, try to remove as many chips as possible, especially in the Highlands where you've got older houses.
Could be lead
paint. There could be lead paint, The fact that it's a perennial bed and a mixed border bed doesn't raise concerns as much is compared to if it was, rather, a vegetable garden. I would definitely not want to grow vegetables where paint chips had been in the soil.
Yeah, it's problematic.
Because of the lead thing.
Yeah.
But if it's a perennial bed, I wouldn't be so freaked out. And it shouldn't hurt your plants if there's some traces there, but I would definitely try to get as much as you possibly can cleared out. So.
And I hope the neighbors are still speaking to each other.
Yeah, it's too bad that that wasn't protected a little bit better.
Sometimes you hire help, things done, and that's the way it goes.
That's right.
Okay. If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Call us at 502-814-8246 or write us at 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. We still have not given up on snail mail.
right, Bob. It's a plant story week. What do you have for us today?
As you know, I'm always doing what I'm told.
Okay.
I never never deviate
okay.
from that particular problem I have. And about 2 weeks ago, we discussed a plant, Ipomopsis globularis, or the Hoosier Pass skyrocket.
Right, and we just had to know what that meant.
You ordered me.
Okay.
We didn't have to
But know. That was a good order, don't you think?
You ordered me.
You're a Hoosier, after all.
To find out what that's all about.
Yeah. Does it mean a mountain pass or a basketball move?
I'll get to that
move?
In a little bit. People will turn off the radio if that's I get right. to it.
Well,
too
I was
soon.
Wondering about the basketball move.
Well, no. There's no basketball move.
Okay.
But basically, as you said, it's globularis is round or spherical, and mm-hmm. Ipomopsis is interesting. It means, there's two ways looking at it. One thought is it says it means it looks like a morning glory,
mm-hmm.
as in Ipomoa. The morning glory,
yeah,
Latin.
Epimoa.
Thank you. The other one is, ipo means to strike,
uh-huh.
and opsis is appearance. So it's got
striking
appearance.
You never, I love that.
You never put that. So I prefer that one, too.
I do, too.
It's got a lot more sex appeal to it than sure. looks like a morning glory.
Yeah.
It's not seen around here much, really. It's kind of in the Jacob's Ladder family, and you've probably grown those and killed them like I have.
Mm-hmm.
It's a biennial, short-lived perennial, mostly native to the southeast, out west, Mexico, Colorado. Likes higher altitudes, will self-seed, comes in many colors, red, yellow, kind of spiky flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Also known as, and you may remember this from your time in the Southwest, red gilia or Texas plume or Indian plume, uh-huh. Spanish larkspur, of course the Hoosier Pass, skyrocket. And I went online, and we'll have this picture online for the folks, I hope. I've got a picture of the Hoosier Pass skyrocket.
Oh.
Feel free to go nuts.
Oh,
isn't that cool?
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's round. As in globular.
It's got like stems that sort of look like dandelion stems,
yep.
doesn't it? But then it's a globular whole bunch of tiny
little
It's
kind of like
blooms.
A tiny white viburnum.
It is.
With little pink spots on it.
Or a really tight paper white narcissus.
Yeah.
Huh.
It's a cool plant.
Beautiful.
And it gets better. The story's really pretty good.
Excellent.
It's rare and endangered. It only grows in a 20 by 30 mile area in the Mosquito Range and the adjacent Hoosier Ridge in Colorado. And kind of dry, gravelly, cancerous kind of soil. It's only found in 9 places in the world, and there's like 6,000 to 10,000 plants.
Wow.
So it's really threatened. Here's the deal, what you want to know. The Hoosier Ridge is very near Hoosier Pass in that area of Colorado.
Okay.
Hoosier Pass is on the Continental Divide, 11,541 feet, between Mount Democrat, who do you suppose to name that, and Hoosier Ridge. It was a link between two Ute hunting grounds 500 years ago,
mm-hmm.
traveled by Kit Carson and John Fremont, and a minister named John Dreyer, this is funny, he crossed it on foot 1,000 times ministering to people, and he put boards on his feet. He was the first skier in Colorado.
Oh, wow. Excellent.
He invented Vail. Here's what you want to know. In the 1860s, some miners from a Midwestern state set up shop in a nearby gulch.
Hmm.
Guess what the state was?
Indiana.
Yep. So Hoosier Gulch became Hoosier Pass. Hence the Hoosier Pass sky rocket.
Excellent. Because I still want to know where the word Hoosier came from.
Indiana.
I know, but like, what does it mean?
Well, they've wondered about that for a zillion years.
Yeah, exactly.
Hoosier Mom is the quickest one, but there's other ways to...
There's got to be another way.
Another one they thought was, who's there? People going by in the night say, who's there?
Oh, uh-huh.
Travelers.
Uh-huh.
And that'd be shortened to Hoosier.
Huh.
But Hoosiers don't even know.
Yeah.
But there's a poem with it.
Cool.
Way out in the land of the Continental Divide, where tourists pay big bucks to slip and slide, where the Utes once traveled 2 miles high, some Hoosiers showed up to give it a try. At mining gold from a mountaintop stream, an utterly absurd, impossible dream of striking it rich so far from home, where bears and wolves and thieves did roam. Yet they left behind in that grim, cold country an even more interesting legacy, something almost as good as gold in the pocket, a gift for the future. The Hoosier Pass skyrocket.
Excellent.
So there you have your answer.
Fabulous.
Well, you, as I say, I do what I'm told. Always.
All right. Sounds good. You're such a reliable co-host.
Great
Bob,
idea.
And I so appreciate it.
You betcha.
Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to check out the plants and the critters at the Louisville Zoo.
Homegrown is produced by that Kentucky Rocket, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.